Education and Redemption. Commentary for the November 21st, 2020 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Genesis 4:22a, NIV. Recently, I had the opportunity to watch one part of a three-part series on primates on the program Nature on a local public broadcasting station, PBS. One segment featured the capuchin monkeys of Brazil and their ability to use tools to carry out tasks, like the little fellow in our picture with this commentary, using a stone to crack open a nut. Perhaps one might be tempted to think that this is somehow an innate skill peculiar to these monkeys. However, the narrator informs us of other examples of other species using tools similarly and relates how they saw adult monkeys teaching the skill to their offspring. To pass on such skills, someone had to first learn them. This presupposes the idea that an intelligent primate first had to discover that they could open the nut with a stone and was sufficiently rewarded by the nut, meat, to continue the behavior, demonstrating its efficacy to its own offspring and perhaps also to others. Since this skill broadened the availability of food and therefore potentially decreased mortality for those using stones as tools, it can be seen how this would be a skill favored by natural selection, a skill that would appear to spread through the species until it became a dominant behavior. In time, one would expect those who were able to use the tool more and more effectively would predominate as nature selected for those individuals. Perhaps this leads some to believe that a progression of such skill development led to the ascendancy of man from the order of primates. If so, perhaps the desire to obtain food is a powerful motivator for skill development. Pavlov's experiments with dogs seem to point in that direction. Our own omnivorous nature, making us perhaps the most successful exploiter of food sources on the planet, may also be seen to support that view. Our waistlines are evidence of our success, and a visit to any modern farm will reveal how advanced our tool-making skills have become in producing abundant food for our species, as well as other domesticated species that have often been bred and trained to enhance our food-producing ability. Our reach with these tools is global, and we can now enjoy, in temperate climates, bananas and oranges daily, even in the middle of winter, something unheard of by the average person only a few generations ago. Little wonder, then, that when we look for similarities between other species and ourselves, we understand simple tool-making and usage as part of the quest for food, like those Brazilian monkeys. Macaques in India have taken things a step further, having developed the skill of bartering items purloined from hapless tourists in exchange for food. While this is not what we might consider tool-making, it is learned behavior, probably traceable back to the first tourist who offered something tasty to a monkey in an effort to get their sunglasses back, and the monkey, realizing that there was a tasty payoff for their behavior, continued to rob tourists and ransom items. While natural selection shows why a species might select for a beneficial tool-making behavior, when we turn to the Bible, it may be possible to find a case against tool-making and education in such skills. This goes back almost to the very beginning, with a contrast between Abel the shepherd and Cain, the tiller of the soil. Arguably, it may be seen as much easier to simply watch over sheep as they wander from pasture to pasture than it is to work the ground for a harvest, especially after the curse in Genesis chapter 3. That difficulty farming may be eased somewhat by the use of tools. The fact that God favored Abel over Cain may imply God is anti-tool on some level. That prejudice is borne out in the very next chapter when, as quoted at the beginning of this commentary, tool-making was identified with the descendants of Cain rather than those of Seth. Further support for that conclusion may be found in the Decalogue's prescription against images which would necessarily be created with tools. This extends even to the prohibition against using tools for constructing sacrificial altars. While this tension between the pastoral vocation of the wandering shepherds descended from Seth and extending to Jacob, and the tool-making craftsmen descended from Cain, things seem to take an abrupt turn during the sojourn in Egypt and the subsequent exodus and conquest of Canaan. Suddenly, from the perspective of the condensed Bible narrative, we find craftsmen constructing the Ark of the Covenant with images of cherubim. This new form of worship eventually reached its epitome under King Solomon, with the carvings and images in the temple and the bronze sea mounted upon the figures of bulls. It is hard to explain this shift, but perhaps the context of the conquest of Canaan gives us clues. In the days of the judges, the Philistines are portrayed as a thorn in the side of Israel for generations. They were the tool makers. The Israelites had to go to them to maintain their farming implements. The Philistines' smithing skill not only allowed them to craft and repair such tools, but also the weaponry that gave them ascendancy over the Israelites. Experience, then, more than divine directive, could have driven the Israelites to seek such skills as a matter of survival. This is not the only area that seemed to compromise their faith in response to Philistine aggression. The Israelites sought to have a human king rule over them instead of God, as had been the case previously. Reluctantly, the prophet Samuel anointed Saul as Israel's first king. Later, as if to prove how mistaken that was, King Saul sought to speak with the dead through the witch of Endor to determine the outcome of an upcoming battle with the Philistines, a battle where both he and his son Jonathan perished. The Bible paints a picture of a steady downward trend spiritually for Israel for most of a millennium until they are taken into captivity in Babylon. Once they return, they appear to have been cured of making graven images for worship, but they continue to strive for political and military advantages over those foreigners who would rule over them, resulting in the Maccabean Revolt in the mid-2nd century BC, as well as revolts against the Romans in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. In the midst of that chaotic era, Jesus is born, and escaping the vicious rule of an Israelite king, he is nonetheless executed at the demands of religious leaders who have eschewed the worship of carved images for the worship of money and power. John the Baptist heralded Jesus' ministry, and his own ministry may have reminded the Jews of their roots as itinerant shepherds in a world where the words of all were equally respected. But the world they had then, a world that too often continues with similar values today, killed him for the effrontery of believing his words could matter in their world. Jesus enlarged upon John's theme with repeated references to a pastoral lifestyle, with illustrations involving sheep and shepherds. But time marches on, and if the halls of power offered no room for Jesus' good shepherd illustrations 2 millennia ago, for many there is even less now. We sit on crafted chairs before crafted desks, using technological tools like computers, tablets, and smartphones to access an ephemeral thing called the internet. We carry on conversations with people we may never physically meet, but who nonetheless have a profound effect on our ideas, our desires, and our priorities. As human beings, we have stumbled through history, using our tool-making abilities, not for the redemption of the species, but for the consolidation of power and wealth. Those who would speak against this are vilified, and if it were possible to do so, would have the same crude nails driven through their hands and feet and the same spear thrust into their bodies as Christ experienced 2,000 years ago. The words of accusation have changed somewhat. They called him a glutton, drunkard, demon-possessed, and a blasphemer. Now he might be called a socialist, Marxist, communist, fascist, or Nazi. But it is not about the labels, it never was. It is about the threat to power by those refusing to accept that some should oppress others. Jesus called us to re-envision life as it could be if we chose love and service over the desire for power. He modeled this at the Last Supper through the washing of the disciples' feet. While some today may think his primary intent was to establish a church ordinance, I believe he was, through metaphor, showing what life was meant to be and offering that perspective as a redemptive model for humanity and for each of us personally. Once we understand and accept what he was trying to teach us, we will be well on our way to redemption. Thank you for listening to this commentary. You may find this commentary and others at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com, where you may also find the footnotes with scripture passages referring to the incidents that we reference in this commentary. May God bless you and your family.